Yeah, and I think just very briefly to so that your listeners can understand what the Sharia is. It derives from Islam's most important canonical text, so the Quran itself, and then the traditions of Muhammad, which are put together in a whole series of volumes that I, you know, very loosely speaking, could be seen as analogous to the Gospels. They're the collections of his of the impressions, supposedly of his words, as recounted by his earliest followers, the earliest Muslims. And then there are also some sacralized literal biographies of Muhammad called the Sira. The Hadith and the Sira form the traditions. So from the traditions of Muhammad, from the Quran itself, a whole series over centuries of jurists, of legists, actually codified these ideas. Some were already explicitly laws in these original texts, but others required, you know, explanations, etc. They codified this body of law, but it's not just law. It encompasses the totality of human existence. It includes things that could be recognized as religious rituals.
Sure.
But it has a whole political realm which is attached to it by indissoluble bonds. I mean, they're still there today. And this is where it runs afoul of Western, of U.S. Principles of constitutional law. So the doctrine of jihad, this eternal warfare to subjugate the infidel to the system of Sharia, is part of the Sharia. It's basic rights that we believe, you know, come from the Judeo-Christian God, ultimately, freedom of conscience, freedom of expression, these are abrogated under the Sharia. There's a whole body of law, actually, which is attached to the jihad, which has to do with discriminatory regulations against non-Muslims, and they're often very dehumanizing regulations, but they also apply, in many respects, to Muslim women themselves, and they are treated as nothing more than chattel under the Sharia. And then finally, even Muslim men, you know, who are at the pinnacle of this hierarchy, they themselves are subjected to punishments that we would consider to be dehumanizing. So lashing for alcohol consumption, mutilating punishments, amputations for theft, and stoning to death for adultery, although that usually happens to women.
By the way, I would just giving a Christian perspective here. You're coming from a Jewish perspective. I'm coming from a Christian perspective. I would say that the Gospels would be part of the sacred text, which would be the Holy Bible, to use the analogy that, you know, to compare the Bible with, say, the Quran. But the Hadith would be like the writings of the early church fathers. So in other
maybe
words,
that's a better analogy.
Yeah. Just to use that analogy. Okay. So the maybe a listener down, you know, who's listening to us that's thinking, wait a minute. I know this nice Muslim family down the street. They're not about to blow me up. What is this guy talking about?
Right, and I think we have to separate. Of course, we have to separate the dogma, the doctrine, from individuals, and particularly in a country like this, you know, which although it's increasingly shifting away from the model, it is a melting pot, and we are all supposed to abide by, you know, constitutional law. So I would, and Muslims in this country have a significant number have escaped Islamic societies because frankly they rejected the Sharia. Now it's often difficult for them to say that publicly, but that is a reality. On the other hand, institutional Islam in this country, and I go into great detail about that, again separating it from individual Muslims, is rife with a lot of the same problems that we see in the Islamic heartlands, you know, in the Middle East, in Asia and Africa, and this is very problematic. And I think that one of the examples I give in the book is something called the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America. Now, this is a mainstream Islamic teaching organization that trains imams in the U.S. and Canada, but also runs a public access website where fatwas, religious rulings, are provided for anyone inquiring via the Internet. And it's, I include a number of these fatwas, and unfortunately, you know, they're full of all the sort of medieval obscurantism that we associate with Middle Eastern Islam, and they deal very plainly with issues, frankly, that they shouldn't even be addressing. They have nothing, they have no role in this society. So issues of blasphemy, issues of apostasy, and they reiterate the classical Sharia-based punishments, which are death. One school of Islamic law, of Sunni Islamic law, the Shafi'ite school, sanctions female genital mutilation. And that's why, for example, female genital mutilation rates in Egypt, on the one hand, and far-flung Indonesia, on the other hand, are well over 90%. That's because both countries are under this Shafi'ite school of jurisprudence. Well, the jurists from the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America include a lot of Shafi'ites, and they sanction female genital mutilation. They've also issued fatwas which say that offensive jihad could eventually be applicable against the United States. And this is not considered a radical organization. This is a mainstream teaching organization. Now, that doesn't mean that all Muslims in this country are abiding such rulings. Obviously not. But again, there are profound problems with institutional Islam in America. And I'll give you one other piece of data. A survey of 100 mosques was done with the hypothesis that...
Wait, in the United States?
Yes, in the United States.
Okay.
So a random sample of 100 U.S. mosques was identified and was surveyed. It had to be done, under surreptitious conditions. But
sure.
It was a random sample, and the examiners went in and identified themselves as wanting to attend the mosques or something like that. But they were all Arabic trained. Some of them had been in military intelligence. And from this sample, they set up, the hypothesis was that the more Sharia compliant the mosques were, in other words, the gender separation, very specific tight prayer rows, absence of jewelry, things like that, so they created a scale, which was actually developed for them by a former jihadist, and they said the hypothesis was the more Sharia compliant the mosque were, the more likely they would be to foment jihad via actual sermons or audio and visual materials and books that were provided, within the mosque. And there was a striking correlation between the Sharia compliance and the fomenting of jihad. And in terms of just looking at whether jihad was being actively fomented or not, 81% of the mosques were fomenting jihad, either via sermons or audio visual materials, or via printed literature that was being distributed at the mosque. So,
wow.
Again, now mosque attendance is hardly 100% in the United States, but we have problems with institutional Islam in this country. The last piece of data I'd like to give you was a survey that was just published, I think within the last couple of months. Maybe as recently as 6 weeks ago, by a research firm that's based out of the Midwest, and it's a polling company, and they didn't do a random digit dial telephone survey, which is sort of the gold standard. As an epidemiologist,
sure.
that's what I'm used to. What they did is probably the next best thing. It's more of a convenience sample. They got trade lists from marketing firms, and they validated a series of Muslim-sounding names, and then took a random sample of that group of Muslim-sounding names who had been confirmed that they were actually Muslim families, and then from that sample, they got a sample of 600 who turned out to be, if anything, the bias was, you would think, away from radicalism, because they were better educated, they had higher socioeconomic status. Well, regardless. 60% of that sample, and this was right on the heels of the Innocence of Muslims, video that caused such tumult in the Muslim world, 60% of this American sample felt that there should be punishment for any perceived insults to Islam or to Islam's prophet Muhammad. Now, that's a fundamental rejection of the First Amendment. And yet, again, this better educated, better socioeconomic status situated sample, you know, had such high rates of rejection of a core value. So that to me was a very ominous finding.
Yeah, I could see why. And in fact, you mentioned fatwa earlier. A fatwa is basically a religiously sanctioned death warrant. And
no, it's a ruling in general. I mean,
ruling.
Okay.
Well, included in fatwas, if you get a fatwa against you, you basically have a death sentence. Like Salman Rushdie has a fatwa against him.
Well, that's the popular identification because of the Rushdie affair. And
oh, okay.
And more recently, well, let's just go to yesterday's news.
Yeah, the eight Coptic Christians now have a fatwa against them. If you find them, kill them. Say the Egyptian clerics.
That's right, and I find this so. There's so many ironies here. The ruling, you know, the beef that the so-called liberals in Egypt now have against Morsi, President Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president of Egypt now that we, in various ways, abetted. The beef against him because of what he did last Thursday, in assuming greater powers, is that he was putting restraints on the judiciary. Okay, that's what the liberals, so-called liberals in Egypt, are complaining about. And yet, I didn't see any outrage when, you know, a judicial body that's still functioning issues this absolutely heinous rule that is a death sentence to expatriate Coptic Christians from Egypt, and also throw in for good measure Terry Jones, who was not even an Egyptian citizen. Now these other individuals had ties to Egypt, and I don't know if all of them, maybe some of them were dual citizens. I have no idea. But the so-called liberals in Egypt, I haven't heard a single one of them come out and protest this decision.
They can't. As Christine Brim of the Center for Security Policy says, basically when you're in that kind of system and you oppose it, your options are either silence or death. Silence or death. And I think that's true. And I noticed, by the way, I noticed her name in one of the acknowledgments of your book.
Yes. She's a colleague and friend. But I think we have it just drives home. I mean, Morsi is the first, you know, openly elected president of Egypt for a reason. It's not by accident. If you looked at polling data that stretched back 5 to 6 years before he eventually was elected president, you would see that the attitudes amongst the Egyptian population, and this is by different polling agencies, none of them, you know, conservative, they're all left-leaning polling agencies from the University of Maryland. World Opinion Dynamics did a shared poll back in 2006-2007. Pew, obviously, is not a conservative organization. What the pool data show you is that 70-75% of the Egyptian population fits what we would consider to be a fundamentalist mindset. And two things jump out. And I actually can remember the exact numbers because I was so struck by them. 67%, and this goes back to a 2006 into 2007 poll, mm-hmm. Favored the creation or recreation of a caliphate, so the early Islamic empires, and concordant with that result was 74% of Egyptians favored, and the word was strict, application of Sharia law. Now, Pew, a few years later, looked at some of the so-called Hod punishments, these mandatory punishments under the Sharia. So, again, you know, mutilation for theft, putting apostates to death, stoning for adultery. And again, the numbers for these individual punishments were anywhere from 70 to 85% favored them. So
what that means is that if a Muslim, let's say, in Egypt becomes a Christian, the vast majority of Muslims in Egypt believe that that person should be put to death.
That number I remember, Jerry, 84%, according to a Pew poll. That was as recent as 2010, I believe.
Wow.
Given the void created by deposing Mubarak, I mean, who do you think was going to step into that void if there were a free and fair election? So I don't understand, you know, all the hand-wringing about the Muslim Brotherhood and other, you know, traditionalists. Yeah. I would call them traditionalists. There are others call them fundamentalist parties. I mean, if these are the attitudes of the masses of Egyptian Muslims, then of course they're going to elect people like that. And, you know, I don't know why there's any great surprise about it.
Sure. Okay, we're talking right now with Andrew Bostom. That's like the word Boston, but with an M at the end. His book is called Sharia versus Freedom, The Legacy of Islamic Totalitarianism. An incredible book, very big, very thick, very well documented, and also with a great index. And just for the commercial, give us a website or something for more information on the book, and then I'm going to ask you another question.
Oh, sure. It's www, it could be all lowercase, dot Andrew Bostom, all together as one word, .org, and then for the blog, it would just be /blog.
Okay, here's the phrase from the Muslim Brotherhood. The Quran is our constitution, the Prophet Muhammad is our leader, jihad is our path, and death for the sake of Allah is our most lofty aspiration. Can you comment on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's been the credo from the movement's founding by Hassan al-Banna in the late 1920s. Frankly, it's also part of the Hamas covenant, the 1988 Hamas covenant, and Hamas just views itself as an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. But it ties together the centrality of jihad and martyrdom for the spread of Islam and its Sharia, and this is the abiding these are the abiding principles of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a mass Sunni movement, and we're seeing this now reflected in the other unrest that's characterized the Orwellian named Arab Spring. I mean, so the movement has finally broken through in gaining access to political machinery and actual voting, it's
wow.
Not the least bit surprising. It's a traditionalist Islamic movement. You know, Islam has had many reformations, but somehow it missed both the Renaissance and the celebration of the individual. And the Enlightenment and the separation of church and state, but it's had reformation after reformation after reformation driving it back to the foundational sources.
Hmm. Yeah, and in fact, it's like one of the specials we did many years ago. The question within Islam for the good Muslim is, what would Muhammad do? Just like we talk about, what would Jesus do? What would Muhammad do? And Muhammad was a warrior, a religious warrior. And there's
he was getting around that. He was a prototype jihadist. I mean, this was actually stated, speaking of the Muslim Brotherhood, by their spiritual guide, their overall spiritual guide, Yusuf al-Qaradawi. He gave a sermon back in 2011, which translates into English, the Prophet Muhammad as a jihad model.
It's amazing in your book to see so many different parts where you're talking about Adolf Hitler and how Hitler worked together with some Muslim groups because of their mutual hatred of Jews.
Well, there is a connection. Hitler romanticized Islam, and Muslims romanticized Hitler. I mean, it's probably the simplest way to put it. One of Hitler's colleagues maintains, and we don't know if this is apocryphal, that he commented about being disappointed that Charles Martel had defeated the Muslims known in that era as the Moors, and prevented the more extensive Islamization of Western Europe. He had hoped, again, according to this anecdote, that Germany had been Islamized and that it wouldn't have what he saw as this flimsy religion, Christianity. It would have had, you know, the manly and warlike religion of Islam, and that combined with the pagan Teutonic lineage would have created a master race all the way back then. You know, there's an account as far back as 1926 of Hitler having read the work of this Indian jihadist who was known as al-Mashriqi, and eventually they met. And again, according to al-Mashriqi, Hitler extolled jihadism and was very aware of it, you know, again, relatively early in his political career.
Hmm. All right, we have just a couple of minutes to wrap up. What do you want us to know about Sharia versus freedom? What do you want to say in the last couple of minutes?
Well, I think what we have to understand is that they are antithetical. The Sharia is really certainly in its political aspects, it's a totalitarian system, very much analogous to modern totalitarian movements that are much more familiar to Americans, like fascism and like communism. And that it must absolutely, you know, no encroachment of the Sharia. You know, there's been talk about family courts and things like that, but even those aspects would be intolerable for Muslim women in terms of the discriminations, even in, you know, common divorce cases, etc. So I think we have to be very steadfast in saying that there is absolutely no room for Sharia in a society like ours. And moreover, if we are to get involved in further adventures in the Muslim world, we should have absolutely nothing to do, as we unfortunately did in Afghanistan and Iraq, in creating Sharia-based constitutions or in promoting them.
Oh, that's an excellent point. What about honor killings in Sharia?
Well, there there are aspects of Islamic law, you know, absolute deference to parental wishes. You can look at this in some of the common Islamic law manuals, like Reliance of the Traveler, which is probably the best one available translated into English and still used by Al-Azhar University, the sort of Vatican of Sunni Islam in Egypt, which would allow this practice. Some of it is tribal; it doesn't just occur in Islamic societies. But absolutely, it has certainly become an endemic problem, not only in Islamic societies, but in Muslim communities that live in the in non-Muslim majority communities.
Well, that's true. In fact, for example, there was a father, taxi driver, I believe, in Texas, who shot in cold blood his two daughters because they were starting to date some, you know, Western boys, Americans. And he shot them and then, you know, went on a flight to Egypt and so forth. This is, done with the sanction, as he understood it, of Sharia. So Sharia versus freedom?
Well, they're considered, you know, they can be accused of blasphemy, they can be accused of apostasy, and obviously those are offenses punishable by death.
Yeah, absolutely. Sharia versus freedom, an incredible book, must have especially if you want to really understand this threat. The Legacy of Islamic Totalitarianism, that again is the subtitle. Andrew Bostom has put this together. Thank you so much for writing this.
Thank you, Jerry.
Congratulations. And the website for more information is Andrew Bostom, like Boston, but with an M at the end, .org. Thank you so much and all the best.
Thanks again. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, that wraps up today's program. And be sure to tune in next week for Vocal Point. I'm your host, Dr. Jerry Newcomb. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Vocal Point. The views and opinions were those of the host, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of GraceNetRadio.com or any of its staff, management, or affiliations. Join us next Thursday at noon for Vocal Point on GraceNetRadio.com.